From New Jersey to Texas, California to Vermont, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Federal Reserve did not cut interest rates, but recently released data shows the U.S. economy is strong. Phil Kirpin from American Commitment is here to discuss. There has been a major development in the race for governor of California. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Where is the line between free speech and libel? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Dan Greenberg of the Cato Institute about his forthcoming documentary, American Libel. The so-called cuts in Medicaid included in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act are actually just a slowing of the rate of growth. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. U.S. gross domestic product grew at a healthy 3% in the second quarter. Job growth was robust, and inflation remained in check. Still, the Federal Reserve declined to lower target interest rates. Here to discuss the health of the U.S. economy is Phil Kirpin. He is president of American Commitment. Phil, good to have you back with us on American Radio Journal. Phil, there was a lot of economic news this past week, most of it good news. However, the Fed once again has declined to lower its target interest rates, this despite pressure from President Trump. Interested in your thoughts on the Fed's decision to just stand pat for right now.
Their preferred inflation measure is basically right at the target. And so I think they certainly could have resumed cutting last year. They had a couple of cuts, and I don't think the data really were any different than what we're looking at now. So it does appear that they've got a political double standard of sorts going on. When they thought it would benefit Biden, they were willing to cut. Now they're in sort of this war of words with President Trump, and they kind of want to stand pat, I think, to stand up to him or exercise independence or what have you. We did have two dissents. We had two votes against this current action. So Powell doesn't have a total iron-fisted grip on what the Fed does. Typically, these decisions are unanimous. So the fact that there were two votes against him is kind of notable. But the expectation has been that there's going to be one or two cuts this year. That could still be the case. September was probably always going to be the earliest one after they sort of had established that they were going to kind of resist President Trump. And he's decided not to fire him. So, we're going to have six, 7, or 8 more months of this uneasy back and forth between the two, and then we'll have a new Fed chair.
Aside from the fact that the Fed decided not to lower interest rates, some really good news this past week. The nation's GDP ticked upwards by some 3% in the second quarter, that after there was a little bit of a regression in the first quarter. Do you think this is starting to reflect some of the economic policies of the president and the fact that Congress actually did get its act together and passed the One Big Beautiful Bill?
Well, I don't think we're necessarily seeing much of the effect of the bill yet in the second quarter numbers, because the second quarter runs through the end of June. They passed the bill in the beginning of July. And so really the third quarter will be the one that really tells us if it had an effect. But I do think that we did see some positives in anticipation of that bill passing. We started to see capital expenditures increase. And, I think a lot of that was because they kind of knew that the expensing provisions were going to pass with retroactive effect. And in fact, they did. But, it's one thing to start to see some investment come off the sidelines in anticipation of a tax cut. It's another thing to actually know that the tax cut is passed and that, if you make investments in equipment and software, certain qualified production facilities, you can write that off in the first year. And so I think where we're really going to see the big impact is going to be in the third quarter. But anytime they publish a GDP report that starts with a 3, that's pretty good. That's where you want to be. And, that beat the expectations. And, I think that we also got the ADP report. We don't have the official jobs report yet. We get that on Friday. But the ADP report suggests that private sector jobs picked up pretty significantly in the last month also. And, that had been one of our concerns, is that the growth had mostly been in the healthcare sector and in the government sector. And if we're starting to see more production jobs, that would be really positive. And so there's some indications that the economy may be starting to accelerate, but it's a little bit early to say. We need to see that third quarter, I think, to really know which direction this is going.
Looking back to last spring, we had a situation where President Trump started placing all these tariffs on different countries, somewhat of a bargaining tool for the most part. The markets reacted badly. They have since shrugged it off and completely recovered, moved up to some new heights. But your thoughts on tariffs. Do you see the tariffs as contributing to inflation, or is evidence starting to emerge that maybe the tariffs aren't going to cause an inflationary cycle?
The sectors that are products that are heavily import dominated have gone up in price. And so we are seeing some pass through. But in the context of the overall economy, it hasn't been that much. And the overall price level has been very, very moderate, the increase, much less than what we saw during the Biden years. And I think it's a combination of the deregulation, the strong energy policies, and the tax policies on the domestic side that, for the most part, more than offset what we're seeing on the tariffs. So it's not that the economic theory is wrong. The tariffs do, all else equal, tend to increase prices and cause economic harm, as any tax would. But I think you need to look at it in the context of everything else that's going on. And the Trump agenda overall is very pro-growth and is very anti-inflationary, because we're expanding, you know, the quantity of goods and services that are produced. And we have a lot of other tax cuts that have passed as well. And so, you know, I think the way to think about this, the way I've been thinking about it, is it's not so much protective tariffs for the most part, because we've now got a series of major deals with our largest trading partners, and we're at, 15% with Japan, 15% with Europe, 10% with the United Kingdom. These are certainly not, insignificant, but compared to the 40, 50, 60, 70% that was threatened on April 2nd, these are much less about stopping the volume of trade in any significant way, and much more about raising money to fund the federal government, which has been kind of offset with other tax cuts. And so I think that it's being used more as a revenue source than it is as a protective measure. And there are economic harms associated with any tax, but they've mostly been offset by other elements of the Trump agenda.
So we have now had the one big beautiful bill. We have had a rescission package. There's talk about a second big beautiful bill, I guess you could call it. What are you hearing on that? What steps does Congress now need to take? What are the next steps that are going to unfold here as the president and Congress try to get the economy back on track?
Maybe it won't happen until next year. We'll have to see. But every time this speaker has said he's going to do something, and I think it's going to take longer, he's proven right and I'm proven wrong. And they got this last one cleared by July 4th that I thought was going to take all year. So I think we have to consider the possibility that they will, in fact, do it this year. And it'll be the first time ever we get two of these things done in a single year. But I think they may be able to. So right now, it goes back to the starting blocks, which is the House Budget Committee, which will write a budget resolution, and that will lay out the parameters for the different committees to write their reconciliation instructions and to pile it into a reconciliation bill. The chairman of the House Budget Committee, Jody Arrington from Texas, has said that they are starting to collect ideas for this, and he wants to start with two ideas that I'm a huge proponent of, and these are two health care reforms that I think would be massively beneficial. And one of them is what's called site-neutral payment in Medicare, and this is the idea that Medicare shouldn't pay more for your visit to a doctor's office if your doctor gets acquired by the hospital system than they do when he's just an independent physician. And this has been a massive problem in recent years, as the hospital systems have just been gobbling up every physician's practice because we pay more for the exact same doctor's visit if it can be called, a satellite campus of the hospital system, even though it's the exact same doctor's office it always was, which is insane and is terrible for taxpayers because we're paying more unnecessarily. But it's also just really bad for the quality of healthcare that all our doctors are, instead of being independent, are becoming part of these massive bureaucratized systems. And so I love that that's a starting point that he says he wants to do, that we're going to pay the same regardless of whether a doctor's independent or part of a hospital system. I think that's a really good reform for Medicare. And he also says he wants to do the unfinished business of Medicaid, which is to cut that massive federal overmatch that we have for able-bodied working-age adults, where we basically say we'll pay seven times more per dollar of state spending for an able-bodied, non-disabled working-age adult than we do for pregnant women, the disabled, and seniors, which is just such an insane, perverse incentive in Medicaid. I was so disappointed when they didn't do anything to address that in the first reconciliation bill. So if he says he wants to get at that in the second, those are two fantastic starting points. And, we'll see. I've got some tax ideas I'd love to see in there also, like inflation indexing the capital gains tax, because every capital asset in the country now has a big bulge of inflation in the notional gain, but that doesn't represent any increase in purchasing power. There's no reason we should tax it. And so we'll see. I don't know how much appetite there is to do a lot more on tax, but if they're willing to take on some of these tough things in healthcare, that would be fantastic.
Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. Phil, tell us a bit about American Commitment.
We're a national free market advocacy group. We work really on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues, and we try to sort of hone in on the fights where the outcome is not determined, where a little bit more citizen education and engagement can make the difference and tip things in a more free market direction. And all our stuff is on the website, AmericanCommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. Phil, as always, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Loman. Have a good one.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. There have been major developments in the race for governor of the state of California, one of the nation's biggest, if not the biggest state. Scott, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Major development as to who isn't running.
This week we learned that Kamala Harris is going to take a pass on running for governor of California. You know, I think this is one of those situations where she obviously has incredible high name ID, but having come off the loss to President Trump, where she lost six swing states that were all targeted, had really, really low approval ratings and image ratings, she's viewed negatively by so many people, not just across America, but also in California. And when she became senator, she was appointed by the governor. And so I think when you're looking at Kamala Harris and whether she's a viable candidate for governor of California in 2026, she would have been a strong candidate. She might have won, you know, the nomination. But people like her do not want to go off with the loss and lose two races in a row, because that would pretty much end her political career if she wants to hold open the option of running for president in 2028 or later. And so instead, you're going to have several other Democrats that are running in California. One of them is Javier Becerra. He was Health and Human Services Secretary and former member of the House Democratic leadership underneath Nancy Pelosi. I think he's one of these far leftists that, you know, will certainly keep California at the status quo, but he should be considered, I think, a pretty strong candidate. He was also Attorney General of California. And, you know, then you also have Gavin Newsom's Lieutenant Governor, and then I think you have a state Senate president, and you've got a former U.S. Representative, Katie Porter. You know, she can raise a boatload of money, and she did that in her losing Senate race to Adam Schiff last cycle. But these people are addicted to politics, and even after they lose big races, they still want to have that power over you and your wallet and all the decisions that government tries to make on behalf of people. But, you know, obviously the Democrats' vision, a socialist vision of California, doesn't work well in the rest of America. I think that's part of why Kamala is not running for governor. And, you know, hopefully we can have a Republican. Who knows if it'll be Steve Hilton, one of the Fox contributors, or somebody else that can be competitive. California has what's known as a jungle primary. And so you have everybody from the Republican and Democrat side, independents, all on the ballot at the same time. And the top two finishers, regardless of party, advance to the general election. And so you never know. Maybe there's a Republican that can get 25%. And maybe these Democrats, one's held down to 30 and the next one's down at 23. So then what happens when you get to a general election? I think certainly such a populous state, there's a lot of Republicans there, and they need to exercise their vote too.
Well, we'll certainly keep an eye on California. Obviously not very fertile ground for Republicans. Meanwhile, back in the nation's capital, we do have a big date coming up, October 1st, the deadline for the new federal budget, which actually hasn't happened in, what, decades now? So is work underway on a continuing resolution here, Scott? I know the House is out for August recess, but even though the House stands in recess, a lot of work continues to be done.
I think even though they're gone for the rest of August, you've got a lot of committee staffers that are pulling the drafted bill out of their top desk drawers, is kind of the analogy we like to use here, because it seems like it's all a fait accompli in where the appropriations process is headed. We are not underneath regular order. We're not passing individual appropriation bills. And instead, we think there's going to be a continuing resolution that pushes us back up into the December deadline of Christmas. You've heard me talk about this the last 6 years, because it's the same old story in Washington, D.C. when it comes to spending taxpayer dollars.
You referenced regular order. Is there really such a thing as regular order anymore? It's been a long time.
It has been. You know, I think we've only done one individual appropriation bill over the last 20 years, and that was, I think, related to Homeland Security. And most of the time, they load up several bills together. Sometimes it's six bills that are deemed to be security in nature and six bills that are non-security. You know, regular order has sort of fallen to the wayside. The House did a good job last year. I think they passed most of their appropriation bills. They didn't get to everything, but the Senate and the filibuster and the way that that negotiation happens, it just never proceeds underneath regular order. And ultimately, the Appropriations Committee is one of a uniparty.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott, of course, with the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Well, if you're fed up like we are with the bloated federal government, you can check us out at clubforgrowth.org, learn more about the policy positions that we support, limiting government, supporting economic opportunity and liberty, and the website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
There is free speech, and then there is libel. What is the difference? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores the issue with Dan Greenberg of the Cato Institute, who is about to release a documentary entitled American Libel.
The First Amendment protects a right to a free press, obviously, but if there's no accountability when the press gets something wrong, does that make it more difficult to trust journalists, even the ones who get it right? Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Dan Greenberg. He's a senior research fellow at the Cato Institute, and he's the writer and producer of a new film called American Libel that will be out in October, a documentary film, I should say, that takes a look at libel law and makes the argument that the Supreme Court needs to start taking libel a bit more seriously as a way to make the journalism profession more accountable and also more trusted. And he joins us now on the phone to talk about the film and these kind of high-level concepts, maybe a bit abstract concepts here, Dan, but really looking forward to seeing this movie and really glad to have you here on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on to talk about my new passion project.
Yeah, passion project. That's exactly how I was going to describe this. This is a passion project of yours, documentary that comes from a real personal place for you. Tell us about the kind of the idea behind American Libel.
Well, American Libel is about libel. Right. And you know what libel is. It's a branch of the law. And the law basically has a moral lesson in it. And the moral lesson of the law is if you hurt me, you must pay me. And you know how that works. You know, if you hit someone with a car, you must pay them. Right. If you go after someone and beat them up, you must pay them. And the libel action is about the question of if you say something negative, if you say something awful, if you say something mean or false about a person, under what circumstances must you pay them? Under what circumstances are they eligible to go to court and demand payment from what we call the tortfeasor? And the interesting thing about libel is that it's possible to hurt people through statements without having any personal liability. And this is of special interest, to journalists, because journalists are in the business of saying things about other people. And what we learn when we study the history of libel, what we learn is that if you have a stupid or careless journalist who, for instance, publishes a series of stories about how someone's a criminal or someone is incompetent, something like that. If that journalist is really sort of stupid or careless and publishes all these accusations, then there's no way for the journalist to get in trouble, because in order to have a successful libel action, the story that's published not only needs to be false, but the journalist in question has to have what we call malice, which is something like ill will. In particular, what malice is, the necessary element of malice with respect to libel, is that you either have to say something or publish something that's intentionally false, or you have to intentionally overlook the possibility that what you're publishing is false.
I think this is an interesting analogy of like, okay, if there's a car accident, if I back my car into somebody else's car and there's a big dent there, I mean, okay, obviously there's damage that's been done. You can assess the cost of that damage. You can figure out, and that's what the torts process is very good at doing. As you said, that doesn't really exist with libel because you're talking about reputations. You're talking about things that are maybe they don't take physical form and it's difficult to assess the cost of damaging them. And so that's one of the really interesting elements when you deal with libel law and something that you're going to look at in the documentary.
The difficulty comes when you have court proceedings over libel and the attention gets shifted away from the truth or falsity of what's said, because you know that becomes a secondary element. The primary element in defamation cases for public figures is not so much the facts of what was said. The primary question becomes, what was the journalist thinking when he or she wrote and published this story? And so it almost becomes a credibility contest or a popularity contest, because court cases about libel really don't discuss facts very much. What they discuss is, you know, what were you thinking? You know, what emails did you write to your editor? Why did you put this particular sentence in this way? And so what's examined really is the state of mind and the memory of the state of mind of the journalist.
Yeah, as you say, it's very abstract and difficult to kind of pin down sometimes. Then, of course, you also have to balance all of that with the First Amendment and the right to a free press that exists and that the courts have always protected. Really fascinating stuff here, Dan. Just about a minute left here, though, so I do want to ask you to, you know, make, you know, just that balance, you know, explain that if you can quickly, and then tell us where we can see the film.
It's absolutely crucial to respect the First Amendment, and the concern that I have is that when we are in a universe that doesn't take defamation and doesn't take injury to reputation seriously, then people are going to start ignoring the media and stop paying attention to the media. And you can see today in poll data, the number of people over the last 50 years who don't trust the media at all or trust it very little has risen from roughly 25% of the public to over 2/3 of the public. And I think that the refusal of the Supreme Court to take defamation action seriously and to take these kinds of damages seriously has something to do with that. I think that you have a widespread lack of trust in American institutions, in particular in journalists, and that's a consequence, I think, of lax libel laws, because now there's really no penalty to saying things that are false, because it really can't be proven that damages are appropriate. So take a look at my website, AmericanLibel.com, and we'll be announcing showings and we'll be announcing where the film is available in the very near future.
Yeah, I think it's obviously an important balance there, and the accountability that you talk about, Dan, that's really important, obviously, for anybody to trust any institution. There has to be accountability there. American Libel is the name of the film. You heard it here. Check it out. AmericanLibel.com is the website, and Dan Greenberg is the writer and producer of the film. Dan, thanks for taking some time with us today. Really interesting stuff. Looking forward to seeing the movie.
Excellent.
And once again, that's Dan Greenberg, Senior Research Fellow at the Cato Institute. For more coverage of the First Amendment and everything else going on around the country this week, check us out online at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Only in Washington, D.C. is a slowing of the rate of growth considered to be a cut. That is the case with the so-called Medicaid cuts in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. As we learn from Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Supporters of big government are on a mission to attack the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the OBBB, which was signed into law by President Donald Trump after heroic efforts by Speaker Mike Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune to pass the law through their chambers in time for the Independence Day bill signing. In addition to the easily disproven attack line of it being tax cuts for the rich, another major focus has been to scare Americans from the supposed cuts the OBBB made to government programs like Medicaid. As the old adage goes, they are entitled to their own opinions, just not their own facts. The first challenge should be to the very premise of the attacks. Medicaid will not shrink, but instead continue to grow after the important reforms. Just not at the extreme rate of growth that some in the big government camp desire. As it turns out, a majority of Americans support the common sense core of the reforms to Medicaid in the OBBB. These are to get able-bodied, working-age adults back into the workforce, ensure program integrity by addressing waste, fraud, and abuse, and most importantly, protecting the truly needy in our society. As former President Bill Clinton reminded us during the welfare reform debates in the 1990s, welfare should be a, quote, second chance, not a way of life, unquote. In an age where government effectiveness is often measured by additional spending levels and accountability measured in excuses, few programs illustrate the dysfunction of modern politically driven bureaucracy as clearly as Medicaid. Originally established in the 1960s, with many of the very best intentions in mind, Medicaid was supposed to be a modest social safety net for those who could not help themselves, low-income children, pregnant mothers, and the disabled. That was the theory, but as with so many government programs, theory quickly yielded to politically driven outcomes. Then came the so-called Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, and its Medicaid expansion, adopted now by 40 states. This raised the Medicaid eligibility threshold to those earning up to 138% of the federal poverty level. That expansion was incentivized by a special match, the federal reimbursement rate to states that would expand the population, namely to able-bodied adults, compared to a much lower match for traditional beneficiaries. This disparity encouraged states to prioritize expansion enrollees not based on need, but on financial benefit for state governments. From the time former President Obama took office until today, Medicaid spending has tripled. But what results are we as taxpayers getting for that? Perhaps the most disturbing evidence of Medicaid's mismanagement is the estimated $1.1 trillion in improper payments over the last decade. This figure comes from the Paragon Institute's March 2025 report, which points out that the official Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services reported only 5.1 improper payment rate in recent audits, because in many years, eligibility checks were suspended. When audits resumed, error rates can exceed 25% in Medicaid spending. These improper payments arise not only from fraud, but also from a lack of documentation, duplicate claims, eligibility errors, and misbilling. Much of this is not deliberate wrongdoing, but it still represents staggering amounts of waste. If there's a central economic principle guiding Medicaid reforms, it is this: when you subsidize something, you get more of it. When you tax something, you get less. So when we currently tax people who want to work and pay able-bodied adults who don't want to work, we really shouldn't be surprised that the labor force participation lags while welfare rolls swell. And Arthur Brooks' academic work has highlighted over many years this is toxic, since earned success can be key for well-being and upward mobility for individuals stuck in cycles of dependency. Ballooning Medicaid bureaucracy is not a testament to compassion, but a monument to government dependency and fiscal disrepair. However, those who benefit from keeping Americans dependent on government are a powerful special interest group. Therefore, we shouldn't be surprised to see relentless attacks against President Trump and reformers in Congress who had the foresight and courage to utilize the One Big Beautiful Bill Act to begin to fix some of the major problems in the Medicaid program. In our era of nearly $40 trillion now of national debt, kudos to these brave leaders in Congress who continue to stand up to the special interest by making Medicaid stronger through these common sense reforms. For more information, you can visit alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WEEU-AM in Reading, Pennsylvania, WNTE-FM in Wellsboro, Pennsylvania, along with WSQF-FM in Key Biscayne, Florida. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program, please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.